Shall we turn, please, to the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 3. Book of Ecclesiastes, that's two doors down from the Psalms. You usually find the Psalms, it's about the middle of the Bible. And then just move forward a couple of books, and you'll be in the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 3. To everything there is a season and a time, to every purpose under the heaven, a time to be born, and a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill, and a time to heal, a time to break down, and a time to build, a time to weep, and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to get and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? I've seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men, to be exercised in it, and he hath made everything beautiful in its time. Also he hath set the world in their hearts, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. You ever have a Jehovah's Witness come around your house? And you let him start talking, you'll probably never get him stop talking again, but if you let him start talking, he will invariably turn you to the book of Ecclesiastes to support some of his weird and wonderful interpretations of the mind and will of God. And when he does that, he is betraying his ignorance, because he obviously has no understanding at all of why this book is in the Bible. One of the most difficult books in the Bible. And yet, when you understand why it's there, it's one of the most simple. Solomon wrote three books. He wrote a book when he was a young man. It was about a girl. That's what interests young men anyway. And it was a book about the girl he couldn't have. By the time he was finished, he married 1,000 of them. This one turned him down cold. She wanted nothing to do with him at all. She'd already given her heart to her shepherd, and she wasn't a bit interested in what Solomon had to offer. He wrote another book when he was middle-aged and at the zenith of his intellectual powers. That's the book of Proverbs. It is the sum total of his thinking about life. He wrote another book when he was an old man, looking back over a wasted life, a life in which he had made dreadful shipwreck. He had had given to him one of the greatest opportunities ever given to a young man at the beginning of life, and before it was over, he had run his ship upon the rocks. The book of Ecclesiastes is a book that looks back over a wasted life, a life that was lived for the wrong world. It's addressed ultimately to young people, because Solomon wants young people not to make the mistake that he made. So he wrote one book, a book of romance, and he wrote another book, a book of rules, and he wrote another book, a book of regrets. It's with this book of regrets that we're going to be occupied this evening. One of Britain's most illustrious sons was Cecil Rhodes. Very, very wealthy man. He learned what Solomon learned in this book, that money and position and power and prestige, and all these things put together, are utterly and totally incapable of making a man truly happy. In this book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon is a haunted man. And that ghost pursues him from page to page. It gibbers at him out of the nooks and crannies of life. He can't get away from it. Doesn't matter where he turns, there it is. It just haunts him. He was not a happy man. He was a haunted man. And in the book of Ecclesiastes, he introduces us to the ghost that haunts him. There's a fable, a Danish fable. It tells of a spider that came down on a single thread from the lofty rafters of a barn, and he anchored his thread over in a corner of the barn near the window. And then, from this one long strand that he had woven on his way down from the rafters, he built his web. He had chosen a very busy corner of the barn, and of course he waxed fat and prosperous. When he was a prosperous spider, business was good, things were going his way. He one day, walking around his web, noticed this strand that reached away up into the unseen. He'd forgotten completely what it was there for, and thinking it was just a stray strand of no importance, he reached up and he snapped it. And instantly his whole world collapsed. That's what Solomon did. When he was a young man, he established communications with God. And he established a line of communication that reached up into the unseen. And then he waxed fat and prospered. And when he prospered, he forgot the significance of that line of communication that reaches up into the unseen world. And he snapped it. And his whole life caved in. And he wrote the book of Ecclesiastes later on to tell us what happens when you forget the unseen world. And when you become totally preoccupied with this world and forget the world to come. I said a moment ago that Solomon was not a happy man, but that he was a haunted man, and that in the book of Ecclesiastes he introduces us to the ghost that haunts him. The ghost is death. It's the ghost that haunts every man who is living for this world and who forgets the world to come. You'll discover as we proceed through the book that increasingly Solomon becomes obsessed with the fact and the thought of death. You've heard the expression, the fly in the ointment. Came right out of the book of Ecclesiastes, and characteristic of the book, it's a dead fly. Because you see, that is the fly in the ointment. That spoils everything. For the man, the woman, the boy, the girl, the young person who is living only for this life, the fly in the ointment is that one day you're going to die. That spoils everything. Now Solomon was a king, and in the opening verses he tells us that he was the preacher. I, the preacher, he says, was king in Jerusalem. This book of Ecclesiastes is a sermon. And like all good sermons, it's got three topical headings to it. In the opening verses of chapter 1, we are introduced to the preacher's subject. In the rest of chapter 1 and all the way down through chapter 10, we have the preacher's sermon. In the closing two chapters of the book, we have the preacher's summary. As we look at this book of Ecclesiastes, we discover that Solomon was eminently equipped to write this particular book. He's going to give us some cold facts about living for this world. he's going to separate fact from opinion. You know, Newsweek always used to advertise itself as the magazine that separated fact from opinion. A number of years ago, when I was still on campus at Moody Bible Institute, we had a student who took some dislike to some policy of the institute, and it was about the time of all the student rioting and all that nonsense, and this young fellow, in order to demonstrate his disagreement with the administration, took one of his diplomas and he set a match to it just outside the campus and burned it up, you know, and of course that made news. Wasn't very long before a reporter from Newsweek descended on the campus and interviewed this young student, found out what his rights were, and looked around the campus for a couple of hours and then went away and wrote an article, which later appeared in the magazine, Newsweek magazine. It was one of the most biased articles that could have possibly been written. I don't usually get steamed up about that kind of thing, that I'm not given to writing letters to the editor. But this time I did, and I wrote to the editors of Newsweek magazine, and I said, it strikes me as rather strange that a reporter from your magazine could spend a couple of hours on the campus of Moody Bible Institute, and all he could find to write about was the antics of one offbeat student. It seems strange to me that he couldn't have said something about Moody Press. D.L. Moody was the first man to invent a paperback. Today we are deluged with material in paperback form, but the first man who ever had the idea of a paperback book was D.L. Moody. He founded the Moody Corporate Association, which was founded simply and solely to put good books at cheap prices into the hands of as many people as possible. The secular press eventually caught on to this good thing, and they copied it, but Moody had it first. I said, it's rather strange to me you couldn't have said something about that. Strange to me that we have all these students on campus who are here to give their lives to the service of their fellow men and to the service of their God. And that hundreds and hundreds of young people have risen from these halls and they've gone to the ends of the earth in the service of their fellow men, and you couldn't find a word to say about that. Seems strange to me that you couldn't say something about Moody Institute of Science. You watch on TV and a lot of advertising today, you see last time photography, you see a rose or a plant grow on the screen in front of your eyes. Moody had it first. That technique was developed in the studios of Moody Institute of Science in California by Dr. Moody. And it first appeared in God of Creation, one of the Moody Science films. Moody Institute of Science was the first science and photographic laboratory ever to take a picture inside a beating human heart. I said, it's rather strange to me that you couldn't say something about Moody Institute of Science. 500,000 people every day watch a Moody Institute of Science film somewhere in the world. Thousands of people have come to know Jesus Christ in a personal way through the ministries of the Moody Institute of Science. The Moody films are used on campus, they're used with the armed forces, they're used in prisons. They're used around the world. I said to this editor of the magazine, seems strange to me that you couldn't find something good to say about Moody Bible Institute. You advertise yourself as a magazine that separates fact from opinion. You most certainly do. You separate the fact so far from the opinion that all that's left is the opinion. And if you do this in a simple, short article about a good school, what you do with the rest of the news? They wrote me back a letter about 3 months later, and they said I had misread the article. Now, in this book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon is going to do just exactly that. He's going to separate fact from opinion. He's not going to say, this is the way I think it is. He's saying, this is the way it is. And I'll tell you how I know. I've been right down these roads, and I know where these roads end. You have his subject. He announces his text. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. He's going to prove from experience, from observation, and from deduction that a life lived without reference to God is futile, empty, and pointless. Now, since it's going to be a sermon, it has to have a text. It has to be a biblical text. Otherwise, it's just a philosophical discourse. I was interested one day to try to find out where Solomon found the text for his sermon. I believe that perhaps what happened was this. One night, he was feeling rather bored with himself, and he pulled the book off the shelf of the library in the palace, and he finds he has in his hand a copy of the Hebrew hymn book written by his father David. Well, we call it the Psalm. But as he's looking through some of the hymns that his father had written, out of his own experience, he comes across one of the hymns that we call today Psalm 39. As he's reading down this psalm, there's a word that catches his eye, and a verse that goes like this, "Behold, thou hast made my days as an handbreadth, and mine age is as nothing before thee. Verily, every man at his best state is altogether vanity." Selah. Which means there. What do you think of that? And it arrests Solomon. He reads it again. And that word vanity just sticks in his mind. And it begins to awaken his conscience. He reads on down through the psalm, and by and by he comes across this statement, "When thou with rebukes dost correct man for iniquity, thou makest his beauty to consume away like a moth. Surely every man is vanity." Selah. There, what do you think of that? Solomon began to think about that. And as a result, he wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, and it brought him back to God in his old age. But too late to change the way he spent his life. There wasn't a king who ever sat upon the throne of Israel or Judah who did more to destroy the nation than King Solomon. So he announces his text, and then he announces his topic, and he tells us exactly the standpoint from which he's going to preach this sermon. It's from the viewpoint of man under the sun. The expression occurs 29 times altogether in the book. Solomon is going to show that if you live your life under the sun, that is, if your horizons are dominated by the things of time and sense, if you never get any higher than this world in your thinking and in your planning, then at last, you're going to face disappointment and disillusionment and despair and death. He says there doesn't seem to be any point and purpose in anything if you're going to live under the sun, just for this world. One generation, he says, passes away. Another generation comes. The sun also rises. The sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose. The wind goes towards the south, it turns around into the north, it whirls about continually. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. All things are full of labor, the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear with hearing. What he is saying is that if you are going to live just for what this world has to offer, you get on the rat race, that's all. And you go round and round and round and round and round and round and round, and you don't get anywhere. Now that's the preacher's subject. Nobody will ever understand the book of Ecclesiastes who doesn't understand the perspective and the viewpoint from which Solomon writes the book. He is going to show us the perspective and the prospect of the worldly-minded person. particularly ungodly, but with a very strong application to the believer who's lost his goals in life and has lowered his sights and decided to get all he can out of this world, instead of laying up treasure and getting an investment in the world to come. Having introduced us to his subject, he gets down to his sermon. And again, he has three main points that he wants to make. He tells us, first of all, in chapters 1 and 2, some of the things that he had sought. Then in chapters 3 to 6, he tells us some of the things that he had seen. Then in chapters 7 to 10, he tells us some of the things that he had studied. Now, Solomon was evidently tremendously well equipped to write this book because he'd been in for everything that this world had to offer. He starts out by going in for what we can call the world of thought. He decided that he would become an intellectual. He thought perhaps that if he became a great intellectual, that this would bring satisfaction to his soul. And he gave himself over to acquiring and accumulating knowledge. In fact, he became the greatest intellectual of his day, one of the greatest intellectuals of all time. We are told that he was wiser than Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman and Chalcol and Dada, the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in all nations round about, and he spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. People came from the ends of the earth to attend his lectures on psychology and natural history in the University of Jerusalem. The Queen of Sheba was one such person. She came all the way up the long stretches of the Nile, across the sands of Sinai, up into the hill country of Judah, and on into the city of Jerusalem, just in order to sit at the feet of this great intellectual and listen to his lectures and to bathe herself in the astonishing accumulation of facts and figures that he had accumulated. In fact, she was so awed at the tremendous scope of this man's intellectual genius that there remained no more spirit in her. When she went back to her own people and her own country, it was saying, "Behold, the heart was never told me. This man is an intellectual genius. He's got a capacity of thought that is simply, utterly staggering." It didn't make Solomon happy. He says, "I communed with mine own heart, saying, Lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. I perceive that this also is vexation of spirit." He discovered that the world of thought was not big enough to make a man happy. Possible we were talking at supper tonight about a doctor in town here or somewhere around here who's got 6 certain doctorates to his name. Doesn't make him happy. Because, you see, the world of thought isn't big enough to satisfy the deepest hungers of the human heart. Solomon found that. But then there was a reaction set in, quite a natural reaction. He decided that since the world of thought couldn't make him happy, well, maybe he ought to go in for the world of thrills. He decided that being an intellectual led him no place, so instead he'd become a playboy. And he went in for pleasure. If you'd gone past the royal palace in Jerusalem in those days, you'd have heard the hotbeat music, you'd have heard the bands beating out their rhythm late into the night. You'd have seen the orgies that were going on in that house. Solomon went in for every pleasure that this world could offer. He tried it all. wine, women, and song. I dare say he even tried smoking pot. They knew about it in those days. Solomon decided that if this world had something to offer that would tickle the senses and somehow offer some hope of gratification, he'd go in for it. And he did. When he was hooked on half a dozen different things, he said, "Behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it's mad." In other words, Solomon discovered that the road of pleasure doesn't make a man happy. The world of thrills isn't big enough to satisfy the hungers of a human heart. I tried the broken cisterns, Lord, but the water failed. E'en as I stooped to drink, they fled and mocked me as I went. In fact, he tells us that road leads to insanity. I take it that Solomon arrested himself just in time before he went over the edge and became a lunatic. Hooked on all kinds of things that don't satisfy, they only destroy. However, he recovered himself and he decided to try something else. He'd been in for the world of thought. That didn't make him happy. He found that intellectualism wasn't the way to happiness. He tried the world of pleasure, the world of thrills. That didn't make him happy. And so he tries the world of things. Maybe if he went into business, maybe if he made a lot of money, maybe if he got rich, maybe that would make him happy. And so he did. He became one of the greatest mercantile princes of the ancient world. The historian tells us of his caravans that reached across the Fertile Crescent down into Arabia and on into India, bringing the exotic goods of the far distant Orient into the marketplaces of Jerusalem. He tells us of his great Tarshish ships that plied the ocean and came back with the wealth of the world and poured it like a golden river into his coffers. Until Solomon was one of the most successful businessmen that the world has ever known. We are told that the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents. Now that's about as much, a talent is about as much as a strong man can pick up. I figured it out some years ago, and it was a long time ago. I figured out that his annual income was about $20 million, but you have to revise that now with the new price of gold. It's gone up 10 times or more since then. I guess that Solomon's annual income today, in terms of the current price of gold, was something like $200 million every year pouring in to his coffers. He spent it all. In fact, he left the nation bankrupt. When he had become a tremendously successful businessman and he had things all over the place, beautiful things, golden things, why, even in his kitchen, the very pots and pans were made of gold. He couldn't be bothered with silver. The knives and forks and spoons and the pots and pans and all the kitchen utensils were made of gold. And he had become a wealthy man. Had the mind to touch everything he touched turned to gold. He says, "I hated life." And I take it that at this point in his career, Solomon actually contemplated committing suicide. Now these, he tells us in the book of Ecclesiastes, these were the things that he had sought. He just went in for all the things that people go in for today. And he found that neither becoming an intellectual, or becoming a playboy, or becoming a businessman could make a person happy. Now he tells us next of some of the things that he had seen. I remember years ago when I lived in northern Canada, way out in British Columbia, that my wife and I went one day to the home of a lumberman, a friend of ours, had a log cabin up in the hills, and he invited us to his home for a meal. We went in and sat down in his living room, and I noticed he had a picture on the wall. It was an awful picture. It's a picture of a human skull. And I thought to myself, whatever would persuade a man in his right senses to put a picture of a human skull, frame it, and hang it on the living room wall? It didn't matter where you sat or where you looked in the living room, as sooner or later your eye came right back to that wretched thing hung on the wall. A skull grinning at you. By, his wife came in and announced that supper was ready, and the guests got up and they headed for the dining room. I headed to have a closer look at this picture. When I got up to it close, I discovered it wasn't a skull at all. In fact, it was a very, very attractive picture. It was a picture of a woman sitting in front of a mirror. It was one of those old-fashioned vanity mirrors, you know, with a round glass. And she was sat in front of it, and she was fixing her face, you know, the way ladies do. And she had some bottles and jars and stuff in front of her that she was using to improve upon nature's art. And she was admiring the finished effect in the mirror. She had her hair all piled up on top of her head, and she was admiring her face in the mirror. And she was quite an attractive-looking lady. When you took one step back from that picture, the thing began to merge back into a different concept altogether. You got back about 4 paces, and that round mirror became the dome of a skull, and the black hair and its reflection in the mirror became the empty eye sockets, and the jugs and jars and things she had in front of her were the teeth. And by the time you got back 6 paces, that whole thing had merged back. And there, grinning at you across the room, was a skull. And underneath, the artist had written one word. Vanity. Now, it is this concept, you see, of death writing the word vanity across everything under the sun that characterizes Solomon's theme in the second part of his sermon. He speaks of the vanity of time without eternity. He speaks of the vanity of a new leaf without a new life. The vanity of mortality without immortality. The vanity of might without might, of prosperity without posterity.